this thing over to Frank R., who is our state delegate, and he will introduce our chairman for tonight. Thank you very much. Frank?
My name is Frank Rice, and I'm a truly grateful recovering alcoholic. And it's a real honor and a privilege to be here at the ninth Atlanta Roundup. And it was a real privilege for me to see the new people that are here with us tonight. I guess I need to say this before I say anything else, for the benefit of any of the newcomers or anybody else that's been here for a while. You know, these roundups don't just happen. It's done through a loving God and a bunch of hard-working people that love this program. And here at the Atlanta Roundup, we've been blessed. And I'd like to take just a few minutes to introduce to you the executive committee of the Atlanta Roundup. And I'm going to ask these people, if you just hold your applause till we get the last one up, and then let's let them all know how much we love them and care about. Let's start with Glenn Strickland, who is the chairman of the Atlanta Roundup Executive Committee. We got Jay Garner, who is working with the Executive Committee from the Clarkston Group in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got Corliss Gibbons from the Stone Mountain Group in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got Joe Hubbard from the Sandy Springs Group in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got George Montgomery from the Shamley Group in Alcoholics Anonymous. We also have Bill Root from Marietta, who is on the Executive Committee. These people all work mighty hard to make this roundup possible. But there's somebody else here that's very, very special. I guess she does as much work, if not more, than any of them. And that's this lovely lady, and last but certainly not least, Marge Montgomery, who is the secretary of the Atlanta Roundup. Let's let these people know how much we love them. Feel much better about that. I must have done good. Marge is running out of the room. I would like to take just another minute or two to tell any of the newcomers that possibly don't know about it, some of the old-timers that possibly don't know about it. We don't want nobody in this room to leave this meeting tonight and make sure that you know about it. That's in August the 8th through the 11th, 1984. At the Regency Hyatt in Atlanta, Georgia, will be the oldest regional conference there is in Alcoholics Anonymous taking place. The 40th Southeastern Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous was 49 years old, June the 10th of this year. And the 40th Southeastern Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous will take place August the 8th through the 11th at the Regency Hyatt. Combined with that will be the 31st Georgia State Prepaid Convention. And for the members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Georgia, this tells you that all you need is a registration. You fill that registration out and you send it in. And you can believe you'll come there and you'll be loved and welcome. We want you and we need you. Also, we need volunteers. There's a meeting at noon tomorrow, right here in this very room. No, it's across the hall, I understand. I take the 10th step. It's not here. It's across the hall. But we're asking for volunteers. We want people to be a part of the Southeastern and the Georgia State Prepaid. And we need some working people. These things don't just happen, people. It takes work. And God works through people, and you're the people we need. So we're going to ask for any and everybody that would love to work on it or would like to work on it. Or you can love it and like it. Just be here tomorrow at noon. Across the hall. And needless to say to anybody, I am not Darcy E., but she is the chairman, and I'm fixing to let her come up right now.
Hi, everybody. My name is Darcy, and I'm an alcoholic. Let's open this meeting with a moment of silent meditation followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I was talking to Don W. this afternoon about how it makes me nervous to get up here and read this long one, and he said, well, just think about it. If you had to read the short one, that has all the big words in it. Let's see if I can get through this. This is how it works. We have a real treat tonight. The last time I heard our speaker for tonight was in Houma, Louisiana. Has anybody heard of Houma, Louisiana? A few people in here have. Well, don't ask me what I was doing there, but while I was there, I heard David. And I talked to him before the meeting a few minutes, and he said, I know you're going to have to dig very deep to find something to say about me that's good. But I really don't have to dig deep at all, because I have known so much about him over the years, and he has helped so many people, so many suffering alcoholics. And he has a very beautiful program of his own. And we're very blessed to have him with us tonight. Help me welcome David A. from Dallas, Texas.
Thank you, Darcy. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I am an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous am I sober this day, and for this I am so thankful. And first of all, I want to thank your committee for inviting me to be here at this 9th annual Atlanta Roundup and allow me to share me with you and you with me, and for the hospitality that has been shown me from the time I arrived in Atlanta into the hotel, and for the wonderful fruit basket and personal gift that each of us have received that are participating in this program. And the love that has been expressed to me is I can't express my thanks in words. The only thing I know about being an alcoholic is how I drank, and the only thing I know about living sober is Alcoholics Anonymous. And since April the 20th of 1967, I have not found any reason whatever to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, to find an easier way to live sober, a more successful way to live sober, a more sociably comfortable way to live sober, a more fun way to live sober, nor a more desirous way to live sober. Thank God I haven't had to go to one of them action-reaction courses, concentration movement, related disorders institute, sexual hang in there till your drawers fall off, baby. All of those things that some drunks today and alcoholics think they need to be better than. And the only way I know how to make an AA talk, it was read so beautifully by that beautiful lady, Darcy, that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now. Well, it was on the last Sunday in August of 1950. Next month, it'll be 34 years ago that a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come to an AA meeting at the old Suburban group there in Dallas, Texas. The Wednesday before that Sunday, I stumbled into one of Dallas's more affluent barbershops, and I sat down at this manicurist table. Now, I was more at myself that morning. Now, being more at myself in those days meant too drunk. I could sit in a chair for 10 minutes without falling out of it. I could navigate to and from the men's room and go out and get me another bottle of whiskey. I sat down, this gal looked at me, and she said, David, and right there and then I should have known something wrong. She didn't call me doctor. She said, David, I belong to a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have not had a drink of alcohol in a year. And I looked at Edith and I said, you're a liar. Nobody stays sober a year, maybe a day, maybe 2 days, maybe... not a year, you know. But I looked, you know, Edith looked like a drunk ought to look like. Sort of female-looking George Montgomery, you know. Her face wasn't real pretty. It looked like a truck had run over and then backed over to see if it done a good job, you know. She had big bug eyes and gaps in her teeth, and God bless her, she'd been hit in the face so many times and fallen on her face so many times, and her nose had been broken so many times, just sort of hung on the left side of her face. And then back in the day before gals used to wear panties, and when she was a-drinking, hers always trailed behind her uniform, and she'd trip and fall and drop all them bottles and everything. And back in those days, the ladies with their garter belts used to use up the back. You'd always tell when these was drunk. The seams in the front was in the back. And really, the best way I can describe Edith's looks as a drunk, you know, in our part of the country, if you call insurance check, some wise buzzard says, don't get it fixed. Let it sit out in the hot sun for about 3 or 4 weeks, and all the dents will pop back out. Her dents never pop back out. But God, she was a great gal. But she got my attention, you know, and when she said she hadn't had a drink in a year, and I started watching her. And, you know, and I noticed the change. Now, the change was not that dramatic that morning. I had stumbled in that barbershop on infrequent occasions, sometimes that day, sometimes not as drunk, always drinking. But I watched her. And I noticed when she started to give me my manicure that morning, she was buffing my nails instead of my knuckles like she used to. I looked at her. Her lipstick was on her lips, not her eyebrows. She didn't smell halfway between an Avon woman and a whiskey bottle. And more important, she didn't grab her purse and say, I'll be back in 10 minutes, and show up 4 months later. But I noticed the change, and the change was in her eyes. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have two kinds of eyes. We have those sad, sick eyes. And then we have those happy, dancing, laughing, sparkling, sober eyes. And then we have another kind of eyes, them glassy eyes. They'll get up behind one of these things and say, I'm at drink, you know, and then fall over. But her eyes were jumping, and they were laughing, and she looked like she was having a lot of fun living sober. Then she turned to another manicurist, worked at the table next to hers, and she says, now, Moena here is my sponsor, and she has 15 months sober in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked at Moena, and I said, you're a bigger liar than Edith. Now, I drank far more whiskey with Moena than I had with Edith. And I said, Moena, we had a drink night. She says, no, David, I've not had a drink of alcohol with you or anyone else or myself in 15 continuous months. Edith has not had a drink of alcohol in 12 continuous months. And this Sunday at 5:30 in the afternoon, we have an open meeting that's open so the public can come and see how an alcoholic can recover in Alcoholics Anonymous and what Alcoholics Anonymous is not. And all the participants at this meeting, although we do not give any awards or medals or build statues or honors for our sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, the last Sunday of the month after the regular open meeting, no part of the meeting, but the group just sort of has cake and ice cream, iced tea, and we would like for you and your wife to come to that open meeting and then stay afterwards for that social. And I thought that the only reason that people such as you would invite someone such as me to come to one of your AA meetings or AA functions is that you needed to have some good-looking, outstanding, and successful professional man come and upgrade you lepers in the community. And I'm glad to come help you. Now, I see Moena on a continuing basis, and we talk about it all the time. And I said, Moena, although I went to that meeting, I didn't stay sober for many, many years, but there's one thing that you said to me that morning that stuck with me after I'd gone through everything in this God's world trying to beat the game. And when I had exhausted all alternatives to try to beat the game, you talked about continuous sobriety. You didn't say that y'all were around the program, on top of the program, in and out of the program, slipping and sliding. You talked about staying sober. At that time, I did not know it was one day at a time on a continuing basis. And as a result of it, I knew that when I had exhausted all alternatives for me, there was a place where an alcoholic such as I could come to and stay sober. And for this, I am so thankful. Well, I went home and I told my wife, and God, she was thrilled. Because people had long since quit asking us to come around. My wife, Grace, used to say, why isn't it we're not asked to the outdoor parties? We're not asked to the domino games, the bridge game, the card party, scream socials, nightclub suppers, pin the tail on a donkey, whatever drunks do on Saturday. It's you. It's you. I said, you start on me on the Monday before, and you start. You're not going to drink. You're not going to get drunk, are you? You wake me up out of a sound sleep, 4 o'clock the next morning, screaming, did you hear what I said? And then you keep it up Tuesday, Tuesday night, Wednesday, Wednesday night, Thursday, Thursday night. And what a tremendous price society's had to pay. Those who love us, those who hate us, those who don't even care we exist on this earth. What a tremendous price society's had to pay to find out that the more you scream at us, when we get to where we're supposed to get to, before I can even park the car, you're out of the car. You run in, you grab the host and the host. You chase him out of the kitchen, through the den, the backyard, the alley, the bushes, the neighborhood, screaming, don't you give him a drink? I said, woman, you're sick. That's what's wrong with you. But through terror-filled eyes, she said, we're going to a meeting. And I said, yes. And so that Sunday, to go to an AA meeting, 5:30 that afternoon. Well, what does a good self-respectful drinking drunk do when he gets up 5:30 on Sunday morning? Drinks whiskey, that's what he does. Let's face it, it's very simple. Golfers golf, fishermen fish, drunks drink. There's no big mix-up. And I started sucking on a brand new bottle of whiskey. You know how it is when you take that first drink, gets you breathing started. The second drink regulates your breathing. Then the third drink goes down to both heels and just sets you there. Now you're ready to do some real drinking, aren't you? And I'm drinking and I'm looking up at the birds and the bees and the, you know, and I'm hearing the neighbors from, Johnny, get dressed, we'll be late for church. And I, oh, them sick folks. They really don't know what living is. Then I start doing my meditating and praying. Now, we hear it in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time that due to the innate nature of our spiritual illness, our selfishness and our self-centeredness, that we care very little for God and prayer and meditation. I disagree with you. Because I thank God for the grain. I thank God for the farmers that harvested the grain. Made that grain, that wonderful thing called alcohol. We hear it in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time that, once again, due to the innate nature of our spiritual illness, our selfishness, our ego, our vanity, our pride, that we care very little for the common welfare of our fellow man. Well, I disagree with you. Because I used to ask God all the time, God, please show a special love and kindness and concern to those folks that thought that drinking alcohol was sinful. I said, God, if they could just learn how to control it and enjoy it like I was doing, that they would find out that right after breathing in and out, it is the greatest gift that mankind's been ever given. Amen. Took another drink. I drank about a half a fifth of that whiskey and put the other half of the fifth in the trunk of my car because I knew at that time that I was going to be required to have another drink of alcohol later that day, not knowing the exact reason until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that when an alcoholic comes to us, that until and unless that alcoholic is willing to find out what's wrong with that alcoholic will never be able to find out what can get right with that alcoholic. And I went in and I bathed and I shaved and I put on everything rich and nice looking to impress those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Put on a beautiful brand new tailor-made suit, white on white monogram shirt, monogram handkerchief, monogram tie, monogram drawers. Put on my diamond ring, my diamond watch, and the trademark of every good, self-respectful, high-rolling drinking drunk, a brand new pair of custom-made alligator shoes. I look just like a used car salesman. At 10:30 in the morning, I was out in my long Roadmaster Buick honking the horn. And out comes my wife with the rollers in her hair. And she has on, it's that all-your-fault kimono that they just love to live in. And dwell in. And die in. And cry in. And live in. And where she had lost a string around the middle and it's pinned together with a big baby diaper pin. And she's pulled all the thread and the padding and the buttons and the fuzzing off the front. And the front's just covered with tear stains and cigarette burns. And she looks at me with that look, what do you want, drunk? Meanwhile, all the neighbors had gathered out. And her side is lined up over here, and my side is lined up over here. And I can still hear the ladies of the neighborhood saying, isn't it a shame that such a beautiful and fine lady and the mother of two beautiful little boys married to such a sorry, no-good drunk like him. And my bunch over here hollering out, let her have it, David, let her have it. And that used to be the weekend entertainment in every neighborhood we lived in. We moved 24 times before we come to Alcoholics. Sometimes at daybreak, sometimes ahead of the sheriff, sometimes with the sheriff. Sometimes behind the sheriff, just kept moving. She says, let's go to the meeting. She said, doesn't get started for 7 more hours, drunk. And with that, she turned on her heels and went back in the house. And that started 7 tough hours because I violated a very serious code in my drinking. Because here it was Sunday and I started sucking on the only bottle of whiskey I had. And I was one of them kind that once I got to rolling, I was a disappearing drunk. I just disappeared. One time I was gone 9 months. Nobody knew where I was. My mother, my father, my wife, my children, my patients, nobody, my enemies, nobody. And I come running in the house with the same clothes I'd been in for about 6-7 weeks. And I come running in the house and I ask my wife this brilliant question. Did anybody call? And that does not make for good marriage relationships, I'll tell you. But I knew that the only way I could get here demanded that just in case that those ladies who said they were alcoholics, who said they were sober, who said they were in Alcoholics Anonymous, They asked me to come to that meeting that if they found a little problem with alcohol, I wanted to bring them the reason, my wife, and show them the reason, her. But I knew that if I slipped away, that I'd miss the deal. So I toughed her out and found just enough to nurse me along, and finally at 4:30, honk the horn, here she came, and off we went. And we went out to the group, and we walked in. There must have been about 80 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and their wives and kid and their poodle or two jumping up and down, and everybody smoking cigarettes and talking. And I looked around, and I saw them signs, and I says, my God, I'm in a kindergarten. And then I saw, but for the grace of God, in my head duck, because I knew at that time that I was not living according to the dictates of God's will for a human being. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that after an alcoholic comes to us, that after that alcoholic gets physically comfortable, deep down inside, every alcoholic knows this. You see, if this be not the case, then Alcoholics Anonymous would not be the finest, the greatest, the most successful recovery program and fellowship for an alcoholic that the world has ever seen, is seeing, and probably will ever see. Because Alcoholics Anonymous reaches down into a place that organized religion and formalized religion on a continuing basis has not been able to do it. Medicine on a continuing basis has not been able to do it. The United States government, Air Force, Marine Corps, Navy, Army, Salvation Army, Service Club, everything else in there, witch doctors, horoscope readers, biorhythm charts, has none been able to do it. Because Alcoholics Anonymous reaches down in the place that comes with each and every one of us, that after we get comfortable, a little comfortable in AA, this thing inside that says, thank you, little alcoholic, for not taking a drink of alcohol today. Thank you, little alcoholic, for finding a way to have a reasonably good night's sleep. Thank you, little alcoholic, for finding a group of people who love you no matter what you have done, who you are, what color, race, or creed, what you are doing, or what you ever will do. And this is where the great power of our society lies. One drunk talking to another. But I had many, many years to go before I realized this. And then I looked around, and then finally they blew a whistle, and everybody went into the meeting, and I went and I sat on the back row to see what kind of help I could afford those people. First lady that got up to make a talk, she got up and she said her name, and that she was sober and sane in the right mind and hadn't had a drink of alcohol in a year. And I jumped up and I screamed out, you're a liar. Because that's the lyingest, cheatingest person I'd ever been around, and that's the first time I'd seen her without a drink, and sane and sober. And somebody said, shut up and sit down. You know how a wet drunk answers you when you tell him to shut up and sit down? Make me. Well, they had enough there to make me. And then this woman started talking about a miracle, 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 miracle. What seemed to me like 10 minutes on the one word miracle. And after I got sober and looked back, well, maybe it's 2 seconds, 3 seconds, but I couldn't stand it. I hopped up again. This time got up on a chair, pointed a finger, said, tell it, you liar. And this time the put down, the shut up was permanent. Then this lady said the result of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous caught Christ back in her life. And if anyone who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, unless they found that Christ is the truth and Jesus is their power greater than themselves, that there was no way in this world that they could stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself at that time, what a heck of a trick to pull on a Jew. That y'all invited Miss Deal to this deal to convert me. And if this is what you were, I need to drink bad. And I'm asked all the time, all over this country, how come there are not any more Jews and Alcoholics Anonymous than what there is? Well, you see, it's very simple. The way people have their noses fixed and their names changed, you don't know who you're sitting next to. But my mind closed and I didn't hear anything else that was said at that meeting because I violated a very serious code in my drinking and my living because, you see, I started drinking with, working with, getting drunk with, fighting with, cheating with the black and the white wine, which was then Skid Row, today, and I guess it'll always be Skid Row and Dollar Texas. And I've lived on 3 Skid Rows in my lifetime, one for over 6 years and one for 4.5 years. But the last one for 14 months was the toughest. And I'm not going to stand up here tonight and share life on Skid Row with you. But the kind of Skid Row that I know so well, the kind of Skid Row, there's no night and there's no day. And there's no sky and there's no sun and there's no moon and there's no stars and there's no clouds. Just total inner and outer blackness and darkness. And the best way I can describe that type and kind of an existence is just bodies and feet. You don't care if you live. You don't care if you die. You don't care if you sleep. You don't care if you stay awake. You don't care if you eat. You don't care if you don't eat. You don't care if you bathe. You don't care if you don't bathe. You don't care if you work. You don't care if you don't work. You just don't care. And an alcoholic cannot stay on Skid Row. An alcoholic has got to get off of Skid Row. Because an alcoholic will not share his bottle. He'll hide his bottle, lie about his drinking. And if you don't share and lie about your drink and lie about your drinking down on the road, you're not long for this earth. I don't mind telling you. I did not have to be down there because I came from one of the finest families that God ever put on this earth. As a son, I was blessed with the most beautiful mother and father that any son could wish for, hope for, or desire for. A mother and father who dedicated their lives to give to the two sons born of that marriage, and I being the oldest, everything that was denied them when they were growing up. And if one of the sons is going to become an alcoholic, I don't know of a better deal when you've got a mother and father that's willing to bail you out of everything in this God's world and never turn you towards the solution. And 14 and a half years before I got sober, the religion that my mother and father were born in, lived in, died in, and very devout, they lit the candles of the dead and said the prayers of the dead for 7 consecutive days. And on the 8th day, their son was no longer alive in their mind. He was dead as far as they were concerned. They had no son. And that was the greatest thing in the world that could have happened to them. That was total release. And after I got sober and I took my inventory and I looked at this situation because of this hate and resentment as a result of what they did, and I realized that up until the time my mother and father prayed me dead, they were the worst parents that I could have possibly had because they never allowed me to fall. They broke every fall. But I can't fault them for it because they were doing the best they knew how. The best they do now. And God bless them. And as a result of it, you know, as I said, I started down on Skid Row and I started drinking bay rum and wine. That was the standard fare. I was drinking it because everybody else was drinking it. Nobody down there didn't drink. And bay rum and wine. Later on, as I grew older physically, I'd go from bay rum and wine to that good stuff and never miss a lick and come back down from that good stuff down to Gypsy Rose and Thunderbird and never miss a lick. Because I don't know about anybody in here. I wasn't drinking it because of the price of it. I wasn't drinking it because of the smell of it. I wasn't drinking it because it was sociably acceptable. I wasn't drinking it because it'll make you better this or worse this. I was drinking it because I liked what it did to me and with me and for me when it got down in and through me, and I liked what it allowed me to do to and with you or against you when it got in and down and through me. And little did I realize that the first drink of alcohol I took, it affected my head, and it said, David, every chance you're going to get, you're going to take a drink of alcohol to reproduce that initial effect. I learned a lot of other things down on Skid Row. Never get your back up against the wall. Always have a back door or window you can jump out of. And if you drank that wine like I did, you know that wine will hang you without a rope. When I was 15 years, 14, 15, 16 years old, I run off and joined Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus. And I tell you, I look around here, and honest to God, you never did. You haven't drunk, or you'll say till you've been with that crew. I went, and the Ringling Show in those days was the finest, was the biggest, and the greatest, and the best. And it come to a town like Little Rock in Memphis, Tennessee, and Louisville, Kentucky, and Norfolk, Virginia, and my God, the wagons would be drugged through the town by all the animals and the clowns and the Wild West riders, and it'd be a thrill for a youngster. Not me. I went because you drink and fight and do all those things. And I look around here, and I don't see any circus-looking drinkers. But I learned to drink the most beautiful concoction that man has ever made, called Green Lizard Circus Style. And that's elixir, sodium bromide, and Lucky Tiger hair tonic, you know. You know, I used to drink that stuff, and I'd see Bambi and those animals and technical codes of living. I was trying to live the code of living that society would go to school, become a useful human being, and become of service to my fellow man and my God and my country. And I was trying to live the code of living my mother lived, and they had all the money. And if you had already been in all the trouble I had been in, was in, and getting ready to get into, it takes a lot of money to get you out so you can get back in it again. And then I was trying to live the code of living that alcohol was demanding on my life, and you're way ahead of me, you know which one went out. Well, there I'm sitting in that meeting, I'm on the back row, and that woman talking about Christ, and I'm wanting a drink bad. And I knew I had a half a fifth in the trunk of my car, and every time I stood up to walk through 80 people, it looked like 80 people turned around, pointed fingers, looked at me and said, shut up and sit here, and this is for you. And I hated every member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was in that meeting and the ship that brung them over. Because they would not let me go up and go get out and get a drink. And I made a deal right there with Alcoholics Anonymous. That if those folks in AA were not going to pour me a drink and give me a drink in that meeting right there and then, or let me go out to my car and get one and come back in, I was not going to listen to anything those people had to say. And that deal darn near killed me. And it wasn't until many, many years later, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober, and I pray one day at a time to stop. I walked in, and they shoved a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in my hand. May I remind every member of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon and Alateen, and those that are our friends that are not members of any of our fellowship, that it is the only book in print with the two words on it. There's not another book like it, greater than, more than, less than. It's not it. It's not it. And I don't know about you, but I wonder how many of us who are the results of what's in that book, because that is where the entire recovery program is, and nowhere else, and it's ours, and it belongs to us. And I don't know about you, but tonight, after I take my 10-step inventory of this day, and I turn to the God of my understanding in the 11th step that I started this morning, and thank Him for allowing a monkey like me to live sober in spite of me this day, I ask myself, what kind of member of Alcoholics Anonymous have I lived this day? Am I the kind of member who's had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, or am I one of these kind that wants you to believe that I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? That can quote all the pages and the commas and everything in the right context and look real good on the outside and got a concrete block in inside of me that you can land a 747 on. And each night as I take that inventory, say that if anyone knows I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, or if I have the wonderful privilege, and it is a privilege, to sit at the bedside of a wet drunk, or to explain to the parents of the actions of their errant children, or maybe their mothers and fathers, or their sisters and their brothers, or their neighbors, or their loved ones. Have I lived this kind of day that they said, yes, I want what you have, and I'm willing to pick up my bed and walk with you. And each night as I take that inventory of David, not of you or anyone else, I find that this alcoholic falls far short for what I personally believe that Alcoholics Anonymous, their true benefits, really can come by. But I had many, many years to go before I was to realize this. And I never will forget my sponsor, I said, and he called me boy. He said, boy, bring that book to me. And I took him the book, and it had one of those dust covers on it, and he said, what does it say on the front of it? And I said, it said Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, what does it say down at the bottom of it? I said, it's the basic text. He said, that means, by God, you don't start no place else but there. If you start any place else but there, you ain't basic. Then he said, what's in the middle of it underneath the Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, there's a triangle and a circle. He said, son, that is the logo of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not the praying hands. It ain't the flying eagles. That is it. Recovery, unity, and service in the circle circumscribed the whole deal. Then he says, now open up that book. And I did, and he says, what's on the front page, that fly leaf? I said, nothing. He says, you know why nothing's on there? I said, no, sir. He says, because you don't know nothing. He said, if you knew anything about living sober, you wouldn't need the book. Then he said, turn the page. What did it say again? I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. Then what did it say down there? I said, AA World Services Incorporated. He says, that's you and me. We own this deal. Then he says, turn the next page. He said, when was this book printed? I told him the year. He says, now I'm going to tell you the secret. Well, I thought I was really the secret. He says, well, the secret is the key. And the key is this. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of alcoholics such as you who have come to us, who have tried to change what's in that book. The key is, let's what's in that book change you. Yes. And you see, and he says, and by the way, when you start to read that book, don't you open up the end of that book and start reading them stories at the end, because you're not the end of your problem. And don't open it up in the middle because you're not in the middle of your problem. Start from the front. So I started from the front. And I got to the doctor's opinion, and being a part of the medical profession, that got my attention. And I started reading, and it's 2.5 pages, what I firmly believe to be the finest writing about the malady as we understand it in Alcoholics Anonymous that's ever been put in print. It has to be, because it is now the basis of every successful treatment modality for an alcoholic in the world today. It has stood the acid of time. And Dr. Silkworth, a beautiful man, writes that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Well, when I read that shot the balloon out there. I thought I was drinking because of the kind of woman I was married to. I thought I was drinking because of them two rotten kids. I thought I was drinking because the Republicans was in and the Democrats was out. I thought I was drinking because of my color, my size, my hair, and my religion. I thought I was drinking because I was recalled back in the service. No, men and women drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. And though we will admit it is elusive, we will admit it is injurious. There comes a time when we cannot differentiate the truth from the false. And then the alcoholic believes his life to be the only one. Well, doesn't everybody get drunk on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, St. Patty's Day, when the sun goes up, the sun goes down, the sun just lays there? You know, it's a way of life. A drunk can be laying out here 2 weeks, passed out, kick him, wake him up. Been drinking 2 beers, and he'll fall back now. Dr. Silky writes, we're restless, irritable, and discontented. I never was restless and irritable and discontented. When I was drinking, I was drunk. It's in between drunks that I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And until we can again experience the ease and comfort which seems to come at once after taking a few drinks, drinks that we see others taking with impunity. My wife used to say, why don't you drink like Herman? I said, I don't want to drink like Herman. Don't even like Herman. Why don't you drink like so-and-so? Fine, get so-and-so over to the house. And she'd come over and I'd start feeding him alcohol like, come on, don't drink like a baby, drink. Hour and a half later, so-and-so would be passed out on his back on my living room floor. My foot would be on his navel, and I'd look at my wife, and I'd say, and you want me to drink like this bum here? Grace used to say, why don't you drink drinking with both fists? What else you want me to do? Oh, here's a good one. People all the time used to say, David, don't you drink anymore. I didn't need any more. What I was drinking was doing the job. But once we succumb to the desire again, and unfortunately many of us will, here comes the thing that separates our kind from the so-called social drinker. I was a social drinker, drank with anybody. Normal drinker. I don't know what a normal drinker or another. But once we set her up, it sets up this phenomenon of craving for alcohol. My God, alcohol when I was drinking. And that's where I found out what was wrong with me at that meeting. Remember I told you I got up at 5:30 in the morning and drank, not knowing it was a physical craving for alcohol once we drank. No, it wasn't what that woman said about Christ in that meeting. It wasn't what those fine members of Alcoholics Anonymous talked about, God's grace, the miracle of sobriety in their lives. My body was screaming out for a drink. My head knew where that bottle was. And that obsession to satisfy that craving comes before everything in this world if an alcoholic be alcoholic, as we understand the description of an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. It comes before family. It comes before jobs. It comes before money. It becomes before everything else in this world because we believe, and it becomes a way of life, that if we don't have it, we'll die. And we come to Alcoholics Anonymous and find out if we have it, we'll die. And that's the difference from coming out there into here. You know, when I was out there in them weeds, it was but for the grace of God that I wasn't sober. In Alcoholics Anonymous today, it's by the grace of God that I'm sober. And the whole key is to get from the but to the by. And if AA gets more complicated than that, I'm going to have to go get me another deal. And as a result of it, you know, and consequently, and then once we sets up this phenomenon of craving for alcohol, we go through that well-known spree, and I'd end up remorseful, screaming to anybody listening to me that I'd never drink again, yet we did it again and again and again and again. And here's where Dr. Silkworth lays out our recovery program so beautifully and so simply, when he says, until such a person experiences an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for his recovery. Well, how in Alcoholics Anonymous do we experience an entire psychic change? As a result of our ideals that are firmly grounded in a power greater than ourselves. And how in Alcoholics Anonymous do we firmly ground our ideals in a power greater than ourselves? Steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And our co-founders knew that we would be restless, irritable, and discontented. They knew that we would want more than, so they gave us 12 more spiritual principles to live by. Call our 12 traditions that were read at the beginning of the meeting. And that first one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Common problem, common solution, common recovery, common father, the oneness of one. And then after Dr. Bob died in 1961 and 2, Bill knew that our kind would be restless, irritable, and discontented. So Bill and our conference voted 12 more spiritual principles to live by, called our 12 concepts of world service. So that the baby that's born right this second, an alcoholic who is in this area right now, in this facility right now, drinking and doesn't know that there's another way to live,
that if and when they come to the door, they'll get as good a break as you and I've gotten. To provide the services, to see that our recovery program stays intact, that it belongs for the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to see that any alcoholic is free to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, or to leave if they so desire. Because you see, at Alcoholics Anonymous, we really don't have but just three absolutes. Absolute abstinence from alcohol. The absolute freedom for any alcoholic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and absolute anonymity on the public media. Other than that, it's all up to our own individual, because we don't have an answer, we have a solution. And we take the solution and we find our individual answers for our own problems one day at a time with a common solution. But I had many, many years to go before I realized this. I certainly did. And then Silky tells us what will happen to us once who has experienced this entire psychic change. A person who has been doomed helpless and hopeless and has so many problems that he'll never be able to comprehend how he or she will ever be able to solve them, can now very easily control their desire for alcohol. The only thing being that they be willing to follow a few simple rules. Well, Dr. Silkworth, being a non-alcoholic, he says rules. But us drunks, we don't like rules. We don't like to be told what to, what not to do. We just say suggestions. But after you've been in AA for a while, them suggestions become rules. Well, after everybody, the meeting was over with, and everybody goes and gets the coffee and the cake and the ice cream, I ran through them folks like a tornado. And I run out to the trunk of my car, and I got that half bottle of whiskey. Now, I don't know about anybody in here, but I drank her down in two swallows, and that's the way I drank alcohol. I didn't put it in a brandy glass and run around sniff it for 4 or 5 hours and burn candles and incense and listen to Lawrence Welk. And I didn't put an inch in a glass and 9 inches of something else, a straw and a fruit and a cherry and a half a Christmas tree on top of it. And suck on it for about 3 hours. To me, that's sick drinking. I dropped her down that hole where, you know how it is when you want to drink of alcohol so bad, my God, it's killing you. And you take a drink and it runs down your Adam's apple and gets you your chest well, starts pulsating like arrows. Then it runs down into your tummy and it runs around your navel about 9 or 10 times. Then it starts heading for the 5 toenails on each foot, just cruising down there, you know, speedway. Gets down the toenails, makes a U-turn, starts coming back up. And it gets halfway between the ankle and the knee and the head, says. I wonder if it'll make her all the way up. I better drop another one down there to meet it. So the trick is when you're drinking is to have one going down and one coming up. Now, until one has experienced the need to have that feeling fulfilled and has experienced that feeling being fulfilled, we'll never be able to comprehend what we're talking about, because that's where the great power of our society. You too, yeah, you too, you know, sure, yeah. But let me tell you what happened to me. I quit perspiring. My hair laid back down. My toes went back in those alligator shoes. I ran up the steps, got a hold of the oldest sober member that got sober in that group. He's still alive. Got to arguing with him about the quality of y'all's fellowship. And he said something to me, and I hit him. Because when I was drinking, I was bad to hit folks. Taller than me, shorter than me, fatter than me, skinnier than me. And two of his AA babies joined in, and we started to fight. And as far as I was concerned, that fight was a lot better than that meeting. I don't mind that. And I was just whooping the dickens out of them two little sober drunks. And they did an unfair thing. They ran in two more sober drunks about the size of the outside linebackers on the Dallas Cowboys. And four of them picked me up bodily and threw me right out of that AA group. As I'm sailing through the air, one of them said, "We don't need your kind here." And another one said, "And furthermore, you're too young to be an alcoholic." And I stood on that grass that Sunday evening drunk, with my fist clenched, screaming to anybody listening to me that I would never come back to this Christ soul-saving organization as long as I lived, that I was not an alcoholic, I was too young to be an alcoholic. But the next 17 years, everything that could possibly happen to a human being happened to this human being. And the only three things never did happen to me, getting ready to get on a drunk, coming off a drunk right to this second, that I never did willfully murder another human being, fall in love with another man, or die drunk. Other than that, it all happened. You know, I'd married this wonderful gal, and when we got married, she didn't realize she'd married an alcoholic. And so when we got married, we didn't start to build a marriage, we started to build a booby trap. One that could go off on any day, month, or year. And I was recalled back into the service and didn't have to go as recalled as a naval dental officer. But it, because things were beginning to get bad. My wife was bothering me. My patients were looking for their work, and I wasn't there. And the bankers were looking for it. My enemies were looking for it. Everybody was closing in, and I had a chance, so I just fled. And I got into more trouble. Went with a combat marine division, got in more trouble than the trouble. Christmas Day, 1954. I'm laying in a prison. Didn't know how I got there till after I got there. And they only had room for 128, and it was under code name, and later on it was investigated in dynamite and bulldozed. And it was worse than any concentration camp that had ever been devised by man, or any prisoner of war camp devised by man. And here it is, Christmas Day, and I'm laying there with a leg iron locked around my right leg, and the chain welded to the leg iron, the other end the chain welded to steel cot, and the steel cot legs immersed in concrete, and the armed guards around me 24 hours a day daring me to move. Now, I was to lay like that for one solid year. That's before I was tried. I'd been laying like that for 7.5 months. And because of my uncooperativeness and because of just being ugly and my resentments and hate, 4.5 of the 7.5 months were on straight bread and water. And here it is, Christmas Day, 54, and I'm hating society. I know hundreds of people who have done far worse than me, and they're running loose. Why me, boo-hoo? And in comes this little orderly, you know, with the Christmas dinner. Now, I've been in lots of places where they don't give you a knife before, give you a spoon. And they count your spoon before you can go back to your little iron doghouse if you can get out. Now, if you can't go out, then you learn how to eat. Oh, you learn how to eat soup with your fingers. Ain't no big deal. And he comes in and he's grinning. He says, ho, 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 Merry Christmas. And I'm so full of Christmas spirit and love for my fellow man. I say, ho, 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 you know what? He said, well, here is your Christmas. Enjoy it anyway. Merry Christmas. I was so grateful. When he handed it to me, I just picked up the tray and I hit him right in the face with it. And my Christmas gift for doing that on Christmas Day of 54 was 45 more straight days on bread and water. Now, that's what you call a bad day. I have not had a day that bad since I have been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got at that by hook and crook and lying. Some people took their lives as a result of their involvement, and I had to make those older, tougher men. And I used everybody's name I knew, even if I didn't know them. And I finally got out, and I talked my wife into taking me back, and we started moving. We decided, well, we're going to raise our two little boys in a Christian environment. So we decided to move to a little town of 3,500 in the panhandle of West Texas. And I don't know if any of y'all are familiar with a little town of 3,500 in the panhandle of West Texas that lives in a Christian environment. That's a town that votes dry and drinks wet. And I was drinking every day, and I got up to where I weighed 260 pounds, and my blood pressure was so high that every time my pulse was beat, my hair would stand straight up, pump like all that. And I had a fat doctor friend who lived in town close to Amarillo. Went up to see George, and George takes a look at me, and he said, well, let's have a drink before we examine you. And then he puts the air on, he runs the air up, and he says, my God, David, it's a miracle you're alive. Your blood pressure is so high. But he says, you know, I've already diagnosed your problem. You're too fat. The reason that you're too fat is that you're a compulsive eater, and I'm going to have to give you some help so you can lose some weight. And back in them days, they called it reducing. So you can reduce. And he wrote me a prescription for 60 of the most beautiful capsules I've ever seen in my life called Nemudons. And I said, well, doctor, is it all right to drink a couple of beers? He said, it won't hurt you. He never should have told me that. So I went and I got the prescription, had it filled, went to my little house to lose weight and stay drunk. Well, I looked at the prescription that says, take one of those things three times a day, once three times a day after meals. Well, who eats when you drink? And any good drunk knows if one's good, two's better, three's terrific. So I just took three of them, drank some whiskey. Didn't feel like I'd lose any weight. Took three more, drank some more whiskey. Ran into the bathroom, turned sideways, looked in the mirror. Didn't look like I'd lose any weight. Come out and took a handful of them. Drank some more whiskey. Sat there, looked like my stomach's getting bigger. You know, our co-founder wrote some very prophetic lines when he said, you know, when a drunk is drinking, it's time out of mind. Time passes so slow. And Maggie, the only sad thing I found about Alcoholics Anonymous, that time passes so fast sober. Where did it go? And finally, I took all the pills and drank all the whiskey. And the next thing I knew, I was out in my backyard and I was picking peaches off of rose bushes. I don't mind that. And they tell me I ran around that little town of 3,500 for 2 days talking in unknown tongues. And being one of two Jewish families in five counties around, they gathered everybody in to see and hear the miracle. Because word had spread like wildfire. The Jew had caught the Holy Ghost. And when I come to and realize what happened, I says, my God, those pills are messing up my drinking, you know. Oh, I'd been to psychiatrist, all the questions he asked my wife. Yeah, but it was in this little town. And Jerry asked if I don't tell this very much. And I don't think Debbie's heard it. But it was in this little town that the entire picture of active alcoholism, how it affects the alcoholic, how it affects the ones the alcoholic loves the most and who love the alcoholic the most, and everything about it. There's a fine man in that town. He owned everything in the town. He owned everything. And here was the lawyer's office. Here was my dental shop. Here was his title, abstract, and insurance business. Here was his bank. Here was his department store. Here was his movie picture show house. Here was his automobile agency. Here was his elevator. Here was elevators for grain and other things. And here was his blacksmith shop. Farms all around. And he thought the world of me. And he passed away, and he asked me to be a pallbearer. Well, you know, that's an honor. And it was a cold, rainy day, not quite cold enough to sleep. And I'm home putting on my pallbearing suit. And so I got to get all juiced up to go to the funeral. And, you know, you put on your right shoe, you take a drink. You put on your left shoe, you take a drink. Every button on your shirt, you button, you take a drink. You got to be in good spiritual form for this funeral. And finally, I drank about a half of that thing, pitched the rest of it back in the station wagon, go to church house. And I don't know how many of y'all lived in small towns and old-timey churches. The basement's not on the basement, it's front floor. And then you got them steps that go up there like climbing Pike's Peak. And you get up there and open them big doors, and you're back behind them old curved oaken pews, you know. And then to get down on front row, hopeless row, and that's where all the fallbearers are. It's like skiing down Pike's Peak. And so I got in there, and God, it was hot, and they had steam radiators in there. And when I was drinking, my seasons were out of whack. I'd freeze to death in the summertime and burn up in the wintertime. And God, I'm down there, and I'm wanting a drink, and that's not sanity. And so the host minister gets up, his minister, preacher, and he starts the services, you know. And I know, and everybody's got to come to eulogize him. And I knew who the last eulogizer was, so I'd go get me a drink. But they tricked me. They had augmented the choir. And so the choir had to sing. And they started singing, and I believe they sang every hymnal in the Methodist hymnal and some half out of the Baptist hymnal. Wandering child, please come home, you know. At the foot of the cross, and Jesus loves you. You know, and bringing in the sheaves, and amazing grace, and I hate that hymn. Because I'm married to a gal, her name is Grace, and she ain't amazing. And on and on and on, and they finally finish. Well, you know, the pallbearers have got to, you know, you wheel the deceased up, and the congregation files by, and they take a look, and then they file down and line up on either side of the stairs leading to the hearse. And I knew I could not hold that northeast corner of that coffin up going down without a drink. And so when the funeral house attendant come by, I nailed him, and I said, I'm sick, and take my place. And I run outside, and I got into my car, and I drove about 3 blocks from the church house, and I pulled that long neck bottle down, peeled that sack like a banana, and took me a drink, and oh, I felt better. Took another and felt a lot better. Took another and felt real good. Took a fourth and felt excellent. Took a five to make sure. And thank God I had sense enough not to try to crawl back in with them pallbearers drinking, or try to drive in that funeral procession 10 miles an hour. So I said, well, I'll just circle the town and meet them at the cemetery. Well, the cemetery is 5 miles out of town. So I'm drinking, you know, and I'm driving in that favorite, this alcoholic, favorite drinking whilst driving position. You're driving with your hand on the bottle, the cork is unpitched out the window. You're driving with one hand, with one eye closed. And I love country and western music, and my favorite radio station in them days was Del Rio, Texas. Where they played the finest country western tunes in the world, you know, and my God, you know. That's where they played the Don't Wink Them Bloodshot Eyes at Me. And here's one that's good for 11 months of drinking and 14 months of crying. Only God made honky-tonk angels, you know. I know. And I'm drinking and I'm driving and I'm singing, you know, and I get out of the cemetery, I'm the only one there. So I take a few honks on the juice and go up, and there it was, the tent and the false grass and the chairs and the grave been dug and the sling, you know, two stands of sling for the coffin. Being real good, smart, nosy, drunk, I got to see that all the arrangements are proper. I see a chair or two out of line, straighten them things up, get up behind the lectern, make a little two-minute eulogy, have a sinking spell, slide down the hill, take about 8 more honks on that juice, come back up. By this time, I'm feeling no pain. I'm toes up, heels back, you know, and I get up, one eye closed, and I see a whole row of chairs out of line. And if there's one thing a drinking drunk doesn't want anybody to know, that we've been around, because we're going to get blamed for everything in this world. I got to straighten it up. So I go aim for them things. And I don't know if any of y'all have ever been drunk and unsteady of balance. and you've tangled with that false grass, it's like that indoor-outdoor carpet, and when it gets slick, it gets slick. So I aimed for two chairs, and I managed to get them, but the problem was my toes hit the seams of that false grass, and the next thing you know, me and two chairs are sliding, and the next thing you know, me and two chairs, we're down in the bottom of that hole. And I'm scratching and squealing down at the bottom of that thing. And the most helpless feeling in the world is when you're drunk and you're flat on your back and you can't get up. And here comes the minister. And here comes my wife. And here comes, you know, non-alcoholics are tremendous people. Now, when I say non-alcoholics, I do not mean Al-Anon. No, they're a breed of their own, I'll tell you. But the son of the deceased, you know, he hears all this commotion down the bottom of the hole. And he sticks his long turkey neck down there. And he asked me this brilliant question. What are you doing down there? And I gave him a drinking alcoholic's best shot. I said, I'm trying to get out. That's what I'm doing. And they all... They haul me out, and I'm standing there, and I'm drunk, and I'm wet. And every eye is looking at me while they're finishing the rites of this fine man. Now, a normal social drinker, if this should accidentally happen to them, is so embarrassed and so ashamed that chances are they'll stop drinking for the rest of their life. But I'm an alcoholic. You know what's going through my mind? I can see the looks in the eyes whom I love the most, who love me the most. The utter disbelief, the terror, the shame, the tears, and that look that every alcoholic, if they be alcoholic, has seen in the eyes of the ones we love the most, who love us the most. Oh, no, not again. And the only thing I said, get this thing over with so I can get a drink to blot out in my consciousness, the looks of the people who love me the most and who I love the most. One of the most difficult things in the world for families to understand is that we drank because we loved them so much. We couldn't stand to see what was happening to us once we get sober. And this is the reason we say, get off of back. I promise you I'll never do it again. Quit screaming at me. Quit hollering at me. And we had to drink in order to get that out of our consciousness. And as soon as those services were over with, I didn't go get me a drink. I got me a box. And I didn't come back to that town for 3.5 months. But the ridicule and the shame and the teasing that my wife and those two little boys had to endure was almost too much for their sanity. I had to leave that town, went back to Dallas, start all over again. I was taking me with me. And it wasn't long before I was drinking that wine bottle and down on that last skid row. By this time, everything was gone. Grace and the kids were gone. I had no family, had no parents. And I had condemned my own self and my own mind that I was going to die drunk, that I was hopeless and helpless. And I proceeded to try to kill me. Somewhere along the line on April 18th, 1967, I found the handwriting on the floor of the county jail there in Dallas, Texas. I've been in lots of jails, and incidentally, being in jail is not a requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'd run out of people and run out of money, and I got down to me where I couldn't stay sober, and I couldn't stay drunk, and I couldn't kill myself, and I couldn't stay alive. And I didn't want me as me was, but me was going with me, every place me went, and I screamed out on that jail floor, my God is in the help. And something within me said, listen, you overeducated, egotistical, and spoiled little drunk, until you stop drinking, nobody can help you, not even me. And I said, if I ever get out of this jail, I'm going to look up those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, almost 34 years ago, a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who could see in me what I could not see in myself. They were like our co-founder, Bill, when he was running around the Mayflower Hotel in Akron in 1935, before AA got started, not knowing whether to go into the bar to listen to the music, the conversation, and all the other things that are going on, or to go talk to a drunk. And it wasn't important that Bill try to talk to a drunk to try to carry the message. It was important for Bill to talk to another drunk so Bill would stay sober. And this is what these members of Alcoholics Anonymous were doing to me over 34 years ago. It was for their sobriety. But they stuck a needle in me that stayed with me and me in AA after I'd exhausted the alternatives. How I got by that old sheriff, I don't know. I got out, I heard that Edith, the gal that asked me to come to that meeting, she had passed away, she died sober. I heard that Moena moved away. I see Moena every Wednesday morning. She's my manicurist today, and last May the 22nd, Moena celebrated her 35th continued sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a man at that meeting who was sober 8 years. I heard he'd went back to drinking. He did. He was sober 8 years. He drank for 8 years. Last May the 24th, he's sober his 19th continued sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called him up, and he asked me, who is it for? And I told him it was me. And he said, well, he says, they got a meeting tomorrow night. Let's just go and get it over with, and don't you take a drink of alcohol today. And that's all he told me. And after 36 years and a half drinking, just cold turkey. Well, it's just more like frozen buzzard, if you want to know the truth of the matter. Started walking and shaking out of drunk. I called him the next morning. He said, are you drinking? And I says, no. He says, call me at 3:30. And I called him at 3:30 again. He says, are you drinking? And I says, no. He says, do you want to come to the meeting? And I said, W, I want to come to the meeting more than anything else in this world. I don't want to live like I've gone as far as I can. And he told me where it was. And I went out there and I walked in, and it looked like the same people that were there 17 years prior. And one of them grinning, and one of them said, we knew you'd be back. And now I'm going to tell you about the greatest day talk I've ever heard in my life. Every member of Alcoholics Anonymous has heard it. And if you haven't heard it, your group has cheated you. We don't have any speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got just a bunch of talkers. And ours is the language of the heart. And I've been privileged to hear many, many fine talkers in Alcoholics Anonymous. But this is the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life. This man then said to me, welcome. Come in and sit down and have a cup of coffee and let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel. He didn't say to me, you never should have done those things. He didn't say to me, if you really loved me, you wouldn't have done those things. He said, welcome. Come in and sit down and have a cup of coffee and let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anybody shook my hand. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anyone said, welcome. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anybody said, come in. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anybody said, sit down. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anybody offered to share anything with me. And when the meeting started, it was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anyone asked me to come sit with them. And I'm sitting there and I'm shaking and I'm jumping, and the drunks put their hands on my knees and around me and said, you're home. You're in the right place. Easy does it. First things first. And after the meeting was over with, it was the first time in the last 17 years that anyone allowed me to stand with them and pray. And I didn't know the Lord's Prayer. And they didn't call me an atheist. And they didn't call me an idiot. And they didn't call me a dummy. And they didn't call me an agnostic. And after the meeting was over with, and it's the first time in the last 17 years that anybody put their arms around me and they hugged me and they kissed me and they told me they loved me. And as I got ready to leave, it was the first time in the last 17 years that anyone said, please, come back. We need you, and you need us. You know, we're normally people who would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, an understanding that's indescribably wonderful. When I got to you people, little I realized that Grace and our two boys would be under roof again, because our marriage had been written off by everything and everybody, and it had no right to be. But only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Al-Anon and Grace's life, that beautiful and wonderful lady, we celebrated our 41st wedding anniversary this past June the 10th, and that's pretty good for a drunk. Now, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you, because I'm in AA and she's in Al-Anon, that our marriage is just perfect, that the bluebirds are flying around, that the butterflies are hugging and kissing and cooing and winking. Heck no. We have a few short rounds every now and then. We have some long rounds every now and then. And the best way I can describe our marriage today is built on solid, constructive imperfection. Because it's by our imperfections that we grow. And anyway, I go to 6, 7, 8 meetings a week, and she goes to 5, 6 Al-Anon meetings a week. We don't see each other enough to have all that nitpicking, arguing, fighting, scratching, and hunting. Our two sons, God, they're grown men today. And the oldest one, when he was 15 years of age, had a butcher knife to my breastbone one Sunday morning, and he was going to kill me for what I was doing to their mother. And if I could have gotten off the floor, I'd have beat that boy to death. But the wildness left his eyes, and he dropped the knife, and he spat in my face, and he says, you're no longer my father, and I'm no longer your son, and he walked out of my life, and that hurts. But only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and a family living on what we call spiritual principle living. And what's spiritual principle living? Just living the truth as we are, with all of our defects of character and all of our God-given talents. And I don't know about anybody else's family. In our family, allowing every member of the family to have the freedom to be ourselves as we are and the freedom to make our mistakes. You see, if I hadn't been free to make my mistakes, I never would have found you.
And when I found you, what's the first thing you said? David, if you don't take the first drink one day at a time, there's no way in the world you can get drunk. And what's the first question I ask you about how do you live without alcohol? And this is what you said. If you decide you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. And in taking the steps in sequence, before I was halfway through the ninth step, I too suddenly realized that this God that you said that could and would was suddenly doing for me what I could not possibly do for myself. And I never would have had that wonderful experience and continue it today if I hadn't been free to make my mistake, find people who were free to make the same mistakes, but more important, find people who were free of the mistakes one day at a time because they had a solution not to live like we used to live. And I darn near blew the whole thing. When I got sober, they served me with some papers. They were going to move my license to practice a profession for the rest of my life, not give me a... And I had to go down and tell them the truth. And last January, 3 years ago, they asked that I come before them and put my right hand on the big, big book and raise my left hand. And I was sworn in as a member of the examining board of that state that over 18 years ago that was there to remove my license for the rest of my life. And you see, this is not me. This is all Alcoholics Anonymous. Because ours is not a personal success story, but one of colossal human failure, converted into great strength by the alchemy of the living grace of God, as expressed through the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous and our fellowship therein. So you see, only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous have a sober life today. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a God today, a God of my own, a God that I found through the 12 steps and through you people in the big book and from nowhere else. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, I have a family that loves and respects me. I have the best way to make a living I've ever had in my life. I have hundreds of thousands of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Al-T, in the world in which we all live. I have a roof over my head. I have two cars with gasoline in them, I hope. I have some reasonable, nice clothes, and I have meat in the refrigerator and groceries in the pantry. And I'll tell you a little secret. If you want anything any more than that, you either oversexed or plumb nuts. And George is pulling his hair out with the watch, and I'm going to leave you with this. Many people ask me, they said, well, you've been locked up so much, and all these things. How'd you ever finish school? Well, I was my class valedictorian in high school. I finished second in class of 450 at Southern Methodist University, and I'm a graduate of Baylor University College of Dentistry, and people say, how'd you do it? Real simple. You cheat. And I'd like to leave you with this. Hanging in our archives in our General Service Headquarters office is a letter that was written to our co-founder, Bill, on December the 30th, 1946. And the guts, and I'm going to tell you the reason for it, but the guts, and it was written by a gentleman, a non-alcoholic, who gave to Alcoholics Anonymous when his views about alcohol were severely criticized all over the world. A man's name, whose family name perhaps is the most famous and the most well-known in finance and banking and in oil that this world has ever known. A tremendous friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was the eldest son of the father of the empire. And he wrote to Bill, it must be of great pleasure for you to realize that the helping hand that you extended to a needy brother many years ago and the widespread extension of that helpful act has been the means by which countless lives have been saved that otherwise would have been hopelessly wrecked. May God continue to bless you and to use you ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. Thank God he didn't say saving souls. And if there is a prayer that I have for all of us, that we stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. We're all here as a result of that extension hand, and we're all in this deal together. And let us continue to allow God to bless us, so that he can use us ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. God bless each and every one of you. We love you so much, and thank you.